So we're in the book of Proverbs on our Sunday evenings, and this is the passage that we have reached. We're looking this evening at Proverbs chapter 13, verses 1 to 11. And the opening verse of our passage is one of those which you get from time to time in this book, reminding us of the primary setting of the book. And that setting then is the home. Whatever else Proverbs is, and of course it has a broader application than just in the narrow context of the home, nonetheless, first and foremost, the book of Proverbs is the instruction which godly parents are to impart to their children. And as I say then, it's verses like our opening verse, a wise son hears his father's instruction, that remind us of that. And it's useful to be reminded of that. It's useful, no doubt, for various reasons, but it's useful for this reason. One of the complaints which I suppose we might have with the book of Proverbs is this: its repetitiveness. The fact then that the book keeps returning to the same themes again and again and again. We might at times reading this book be tempted to think, well, this guy Solomon, he's not really quite as brilliant as he's often made out to be. He's a bit predictable. He's a bit of a stuck record. He talks about a theme and then a chapter or two later, he's back on the same theme again. But it's verses like this, like verse 1, that silence such complaints. Because, of course, Proverbs is repetitive. It's instruction, first and foremost, for children. And instruction for children is repetitive. If I overhear Hannah one bedtime saying to the children, make sure you wash behind your ears, I'm not going to march in and say, well, what's the matter with you? You said that last week. I mean, is your memory going? Is there something wrong with you? Why are you saying it again? No, with children, things need to be reinforced and reinforced and reinforced. And I'm saying then that the repetitiveness of this book, it's explained by this primary setting. The primary setting is the home. And so it is then that in this passage that we're looking at this evening, the pursuit of wealth is being dealt with. Has the pursuit of wealth been dealt with before? Yes, it certainly has. But this is part then of the process of reinforcement that I've just been talking about. And of course, while then there's much reinforcement that goes on in Proverbs and much repetition, it's never just mere verbatim repetition. There's always variety within the repetition. And in this particular treatment then of the pursuit of wealth, it's highlighted for us how different people relate to the pursuit of wealth in different ways. That's the distinctive thing about this passage. Different people relate to the pursuit of wealth in different ways. And so let's flesh this out a bit over the next few minutes. And let's notice, first of all, this evening, the unethical pursuit of wealth. That's our first heading, the unethical pursuit of wealth. That's almost certainly what is in view in the first line of verse 11, the last verse of our passage. Now, there's a good argument for translating that first line, not wealth gained hastily will dwindle, but wealth gained dishonestly will dwindle. That's how the NIV and the New King James translate it, and there are good arguments for doing so. But even if we stick with the ESV's translation, wealth gained hastily, it probably amounts to the same thing. It would then mean wealth gained hastily through robbery or through extortion or through some kind of scam. That's what is in view. So either way, whichever way you translate it, we're talking here about the unethical pursuit of wealth. Or then you jump back to verse 2, and although in the second half of verse 2 we don't have the specific vocabulary of wealth, it may well be, I think, that these treacherous people that are mentioned there, they desire violence, Solomon says, not as an end in itself, not just because they like being violent, but as a means of obtaining easy money. Violence in order to get money out of people. And certainly when you jump then forward to verse 8 assumes the existence of unscrupulous people who prey on the rich, who threaten the rich with violence, fatal violence even, to try and get the rich to cough up money as a ransom for their lives. And so clearly in the background to verse 8, you have people who are unethically pursuing wealth. So it's definitely a theme, I'm saying, in our passage. It's definitely present here, the unethical pursuit of wealth. And of course, we're all aware that it's definitely a theme. It's definitely present in our society today, in our world today. In our world today, there is much unethical pursuing of wealth, whether you think at the small scale, you think of the cowboy tradesmen who come to your house and do a job, and they do a very shoddy job, and they then take your money from you, and they don't care one little bit that they might be endangering your life or someone else's life by the shoddiness of the work that they have done. Or escalating things, somewhat you think of those men in Libya and other places in that region who are putting all those migrants onto those boats and sending them across the Mediterranean, taking from them all their money and promising them a new life in Europe and then packing them onto these overcrowded, unsafe boats, some of which will never make the other side at all. Or you think of that 94-year-old man who has just recently been jailed for his activities as an officer on Nazi concentration camps. And his role then was collecting the money from the Jews arriving at the camps. I guess it's an aspect of Nazism that we don't tend to think of so much, and of course it's nothing compared with the extermination of the Jews themselves, but nonetheless there was this dimension to what they were doing. They were getting rich through exterminating these Jews. They were taking all their money from them. And so we could go on, but just before we get too smug, thinking of all these people unethically pursuing wealth in ways that are very remote to our situation tonight, in ways that we can never imagine ourselves emulating, we need to remind ourselves, don't we, why people do this? Why do people pursue wealth in immoral and unjust and unethical ways? Well, Jesus tells us, doesn't he, in that passage that we read earlier on this evening, in Matthew 6:24, he says there that wealth is a master. It's a master. It masters people. People serve wealth. And, you know, it's possible this evening that you are allowing wealth to become your master. And it may be, you see, that at this point, your master, wealth, isn't making too many demands of you. just demands like this: work longer hours, sacrificing time with family and children if necessary. Work longer hours, sacrificing the midweek meeting at church if necessary, because of all the lucrative overtime you could then get. It's making demands of you at that level, at this point. But you see, if you're complying with those demands at this point, do you really think that further down the line, when wealth starts to make heavier demands as your master, I don't just want you to sacrifice now time with your family, time with your church. I want you now to sacrifice in the realm of your moral conduct. I want you to sacrifice your integrity. I want you to cheat on this person. I want you to defraud this person, because that will be lucrative for you. Do you think then you'll suddenly be able to put your foot down and show wealth who's boss? I'm saying we must beware those early signs of wealth's mastery in our lives, when it might seem very innocuous, the demands might seem fairly small, because it's a slippery slope. There's a process involved in wealth taking over a person's life. Jesus says it's a master. That's why people will ultimately get to the point where they're willing to throw their integrity out of the window and do anything for wealth, because it's dominated them completely. Make sure you're not already on the road to that. So that's our first thing this evening, the unethical pursuit of wealth. Secondly, the theoretical pursuit of wealth. The theoretical pursuit of wealth. Look at the first part of verse 4. We meet a familiar character, don't we, from the book of Proverbs. The soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing. The sluggard. Now this person then isn't actually pursuing wealth. I mean, this person isn't pursuing anything. Pursuing things is much too much like hard work for the sluggards. This person is a layabout. This person, their days are filled with unceasing inactivity. And while normally then, you know, the book of Proverbs is critical of this particular person, the sluggard, you might have thought the focus here in this passage being on the pursuit of wealth, you might have thought the sluggard, at least here, would be exempt from criticism. Because if at least there's one thing going for the sluggard, it's that surely for the sluggard wealth isn't a problem, because the sluggard can't even get out of bed. Well, you'd be wrong thinking that. And that's why then my heading here isn't the non-existent pursuit of wealth, it's the theoretical pursuit of wealth. Because notice then, verse 4, this sluggard craves wealth. He craves it. He desires it. Deeply, passionately. He lies on his bed at night, preoccupied, utterly consumed with planning how he's going to accumulate wealth. And okay, he may never actually be able to get out of bed and implement his plans, but nonetheless, he's doing it. He's lying in bed, and he's craving, craving, craving. And I think this yields an important insight for us. And the insight is this, that wealth isn't just a problem for the wealthy. We can easily think that, can't we? That sermons about wealth are for the Christians who have huge mansions and private jets and all the rest of it. It's them that need to really get to grips with this topic. No, wealth can be a problem for any Christian, for the wealthiest Christian to the most economically disadvantaged Christian. Again, that's what Jesus brings out in that passage we read, isn't it? There's a fascinating transition, isn't there, there in Matthew chapter 6. Remember how he says in verse 24, you cannot serve God and money. He's warning then about being mastered by wealth. And then verse 25, he says, therefore I tell you, do not be anxious. You see what he's saying there? He's saying that anxiety about wealth can be a form of being mastered by wealth. a person who doesn't actually have much, but is continually anxious about not having much, that person has been mastered to some degree. And so Jesus is saying there, I think, quite clearly, that wealth isn't just a problem for the wealthy. And here then in our text, in verse 4 of Proverbs 13, we have this sluggard, and he's never going to be wealthy because he's too lazy. But wealth is still a problem for him. He's craving it. He's obsessed with it. He can't think of anything else. He's preoccupied with it. Let's be warned by that tonight. That's important biblical truth, that wealth isn't just a problem for the wealthy, the theoretical pursuit of wealth. Thirdly, notice with me, the insecure pursuit of wealth. The insecure pursuit of wealth. So look then at verse 7 and the first line there. One pretends to be rich, yet has nothing. It's an interesting remark. Probably envisaging the same kind of situation as chapter 12, verse 9. Better to be lowly and have a servant than to play the great man and lack bread. We're probably talking here then about somebody who spends all his money on extravagant things, on luxuries, and therefore has to deny himself the basics, the essential things of life. He so wants to put forward the impression of being rich, to project the impression of being rich, that he spends money on luxuries that he can't afford to spend because he can't even afford the essentials then. He denies himself the essentials in order to have these extravagant things. And it raises the question, why, doesn't it? Why would anyone do that? Why would anyone pretend to be rich in that way while having very little? Why would anyone forgo the essentials in order to look rich by having extravagant purchases? Well, it can't be the sheer enjoyment of having those extravagant things. I mean, you're not really going to enjoy driving around in your Rolls Royce if you've got hunger pangs because you can't afford bread. You're not really going to enjoy wearing your suit from Savile Row if you haven't actually got a roof to sleep under tonight because you spend all your money on the suit. So why then? Why is it that somebody would do this? It's not because they're bored, I think, and need the enjoyment of the Rolls Royce or the suits. It's rather because they're insecure, and they need the status that the Rolls Royce or the suit will confer upon them. And I reckon then that this is an issue, this insecurity, it's an issue that lurks deep within many in our society today. Why is it that teenagers walk around our streets wearing such outlandish outfits? Is it because they really enjoy wearing them? Or perhaps in some cases, but often probably because deep down there's this insecurity, this need for the status of being cool, radical, different. Why do some people you know, perhaps some of your colleagues, whoever it might be, why do they go out and get drunk in Newcastle on a weekend? Is it because they really enjoy ending up freezing cold in a puddle of their own vomit in Newgate Street in the middle of the night? Probably not. Probably because deep down there's this insecurity, this need for the status of being a party animal, fun-loving, a socialite, whatever it might be. And that's what we see then with this person at the beginning of verse 7. There's this insecurity that's driving them to pretend to be rich when actually they're not. And you know, the only answer to that insecurity ultimately is the Christian gospel, isn't it? The only thing that can really make you secure is knowing that you have been loved by God from before the foundation of the earth. loved with a love which drove him to give up his only son for you. Loved with a love that will never for all eternity let go of you for 1 millisecond. That's the only route to security, isn't it? Knowing that. Because you don't need the status of being rich or being cool or being beautiful or being successful or anything else when you have the status of being loved by the triune God. The only ultimate answer to those deep-seated insecurities lurking within so many in our society today is this gospel of a God who loves unconditionally, who loves covenantally, who loves with a love that will not let its objects go. Do you know that love this evening? That security deep within? The insecure pursuit of wealth. Fourthly, this evening, the regretted pursuit of wealth. The regretted pursuit of wealth. Look at the second half of verse 7. It's the opposite, isn't it? Another pretends to be poor, yet has great wealth. Well, why do they do that? Well, the reason is given in verse 8, and I've already touched upon that verse. It's because when you're wealthy then, there's the possibility that some unscrupulous person may come along and threaten you or kidnap you, do something to you, wanting then to extort from you a ransom price for your life. And Solomon says, a poor man hears no threat. If you're poor, they're not going to bother threatening you because they know you've got nothing to cough up. But if you're rich, they know you're rich, then they'll target you. That's what Solomon is saying. I mentioned this morning that motor show in Newcastle a few Saturdays ago, and the Lamborghini that was there, and the owner then was there standing beside his Lamborghini, and it was interesting, you could tell this guy was very nervous the whole time he was there, nervous about his car and about all the people brushing against his car. There's no chance anyone was going to actually take the thing away. There were security guards and all the rest of it, but there's the possibility of fingerprints, the possibility of scratches, the possibility of marks. You could just tell the guy was uneasy. He wasn't comfortable all that afternoon. And that's, I think, reminding us of what verses 7 and 8 are saying, that wealth isn't always all it's cracked up to be, is it? In your dreams about it, everything's going to be ideal once you're wealthy. Everything's going to be perfect. But then you become wealthy, and actually there are all kinds of headaches and there are all kinds of complications. You've got this Lamborghini and it could get scratched at any moment. You've got all this wealth and someone might know about that and might kidnap you and threaten you in order to get some money out of you. It's complicated. It's not all it's cracked up to be. Of course, it's not just wealth, is it, that's not all it's cracked up to be. So many other things as well. The comedian Russell Brand, he spoke very interestingly to Jeremy Paxman a few years ago about celebrity and about how achieving celebrity is just like this as well. He says you have the initial thrill of achievement, the same as if you'd acquired a pair of shoes you'd long craved. And then you realise the shoes are too tight, they aren't that comfortable. I want another pair of shoes. Walking around in these ain't the same as I thought it would be. Celebrity, he says, in and of itself is utterly, utterly vacuous. It's like being presented with the most glorious meal, and then when you eat it, there's no taste, there's no sucker, there's no nutrition. It's tiresome. Things disappoint. Things that you've wanted, craved and dreamed about, they come and they disappoint. You know, there's only actually one thing that you can pursue, and pursuing it will not leave you with any regrets and any disappointments, and that's God himself. And if you don't believe that, you could ask most people in this room tonight, Because most people in this room tonight are those who for many years have been pursuing God and getting to know God better and better. And if you asked, I can guarantee, ask any of them. Well, has it left you disappointed? Has it left you with regrets? Do you wish that you'd spent these years pursuing something else instead? No one would say, well, yeah, it's not been so great, actually. Not all it's cracked up to be. They would say it's been far, far better than it's cracked up to be. Like the Queen of Sheba visiting Solomon. And she's heard all this report about him. And she's thinking, it can't possibly be as good as I've heard. And then she sees all his wealth and all his magnificence. And she says, the half has never been told me about how magnificent he is. And that's what it's like with God, pursuing God. It's vastly, vastly better than you could ever have imagined. Don't pursue that which will end up like Russell Brand's celebrity, tiresome, dull, faded, disappointing. Pursue the only thing that can satisfy. Pursue God himself. The regretted pursuit of wealth. Fifthly, notice in our passage, the industrious pursuit of wealth. The industrious pursuit of wealth. So the second half of verse 4, we've had the sluggard in the first half, and then in the second half, the contrast, while the soul of the diligent is richly supplied. And then the second half of verse 11, we've had in the first half the dishonest gaining of wealth, but whoever gathers little by little, in other words, just diligently working hard, will increase it. Now, we've talked quite a bit about diligence and industriousness, productiveness from Proverbs over the last few months. Just to mention quickly a couple of qualifiers, and I think we may have mentioned both before. One qualifier we have later on in this chapter, if you just jump forward to verse 23, we read there, the fallow ground of the poor would yield much food, but it is swept away through injustice. In other words, it's a general principle that if you work hard and you're diligent, then you will be fairly successful and not necessarily going to be a millionaire, but you will do okay. That's a general truth, but in a fallen world, it doesn't necessarily work like that, Solomon says in verse 23. Because there are bad people around, and there's injustice around, and you might work hard, and you might really work diligently and assiduously for years and years and years, and yet then somebody comes and messes your business up in some quite unjust and immoral way. So that's one qualifier. And then I think the other thing that we always need to say with these diligence texts is this, that Solomon is stating a fact. He's not proposing a motive. He's saying that if you're diligent, then there is a likelihood that you'll do okay. He's not saying, be diligent so that you will become rich. No, if you want the motive for diligence, you go to Paul's letters. You go to Colossians and Ephesians, where he addresses slaves. Slaves who, no matter how diligent they are, will never become rich because it's impossible for them to become rich. They don't earn money. They're possessed by a master. And yet he tells them to be diligent. Why? What possible motive is there for them to be diligent? Because Christ is watching you. And he is pleased. And he's honored. And he's glorified when you work hard. And when you're diligent. And when you do your jobs, your very menial jobs, with a conscientious attitude. So that's the motive, isn't it? The motive isn't be diligent, because then you might get wealthy. That may be true, but that's not the motive. The motive is be diligent if you're a Christian, because Christ is pleased when you're diligent. And even when nobody's watching you, and even when the temptation is to be a bit shoddier because nobody's watching you, be diligent just because Christ is pleased with your diligence. And by the way, just before we move on, this principle, it applies beyond the economic realm, does it not? Does it not apply in the realm of our Christian discipleship? that if we want to be wealthy, if we want to really enjoy the blessings that are available for us in Christ, we need to be diligent. This is not some kind of works righteousness. We are saved by grace. We are in Christ simply by God's grace. He puts us in Christ. But once we're in Christ, if we want to enjoy all the blessings that are available to us, there's a certain level of diligence that's required, isn't there? And you encounter Christians and they feel dry a lot of the time in their souls. They feel dry. And they think this is some great mystery. Well, why do I feel so dry all the time? But then you look into how much they are meeting with God's people on the Lord's Day, how much they're reading their Bibles, how much they are engaging in prayer. And really, there's not much of any of that going on. And it's not a great surprise, therefore, that there's dryness. There's no diligence there, no seeking God through the means of grace which he has given, those means he has given for drawing closer to him and enjoying all the blessings that are there for us in Jesus Christ. There's no diligence, just this sloppy Christian lifestyle. And I'm saying then that what here we have in the economic realm also spills over even into the realm of our Christian discipleship. Let's be those who are diligent with the means of grace, much in the word, regular in prayer, using every opportunity we can to meet with God's people. And so opening up those channels for God to greatly bless us and enrich us. The industrious pursuit of wealth. But then sixthly and finally, the supplanted pursuit of wealth. The supplanted pursuit of wealth. So the diligent pursuit of wealth is a good thing. That's the most positive note we've had so far in our passage. But the passage rises higher still. And it depicts then a person who is not actually pursuing wealth at all. Not even just theoretically. I don't mean that this person isn't wealthy. This person may be wealthy, may not be wealthy, but they're not pursuing it. That's not what their life is about. The passage depicts a person for whom the pursuit of wealth has been supplanted, it's been replaced, it's been superseded by a greater concern. The concern for eternal safety. To put it in a nutshell that we'll all understand, it depicts a person who has taken on board Jesus' words. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world but loses his soul? And I think we have just these little glimpses in our passage of a person who has understood that. And a person then who, as I say, may or may not be wealthy, but a person who isn't pursuing wealth. That isn't what they're living for, because they've understood the truth contained in Jesus' words. And so we glimpse this person in verse 3. Whoever guards his mouth preserves his life. And I don't think we're talking there just about clinical life, biological life. Life in Proverbs often has hints, at least, of life in its New Testament sense, everlasting life, life beyond the grave. And this person then is concerned about his eternal safety. And he is so driven by that he guards his mouth carefully. You might think, well, what's your mouth got to do? What are your words got to do with it, with eternal safety? I mean, it's not a big deal, is it, what you say? Jesus would disagree, wouldn't he? His powerful words, again in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, I say to you, everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, and whoever says you fool will be liable to the hell of fire. Or James, using similarly strong language in James chapter 3, the tongue is set among our members, staining the whole body, setting on fire the entire course of life, and set on fire by hell. Words matter. Guarding the mouth, Solomon is saying, is a matter of life or death. take it seriously. Our words are serious things. Verse 6, we get another glimpse of this person. Righteousness guards him whose way is blameless, but sin overthrows the wicked. Again, we're talking here about eternal issues. Someone being overthrown finally, irrevocably, eternally, in God's judgment. But this person then is concerned about that and lives righteously to guard himself from that terrible end. And then another final glimpse in verse 9. The light of the righteous rejoices, but the lamp of the wicked will be put out. Again, put out, strong Old Testament language. It's talking about put out in final judgment, the destruction of the wicked in hell. But the light of the righteous rejoices. The righteous is concerned about eternal safety. And you might say, ah, but look, my eternal safety has been secured by the cross of Jesus Christ. That's what we're going to be thinking about in just a minute with the bread and the wine. And that's absolutely true. If you're a believer, your eternal safety has been secured by the cross of Jesus Christ. But if your logic is my eternal safety has been secured by the cross of Jesus Christ, therefore it doesn't matter if my life now revolves around the pursuit of wealth. That's sure evidence that your eternal safety hasn't been secured by the cross of Jesus Christ. Someone whose eternal safety has been secured by the cross of Jesus Christ will evidence that in a lifestyle that is different, that is distinct, that is no longer driven by the pursuit of wealth or the pursuit of anything else finite and temporary and insignificant. If you've truly been saved by the cross and the grace of the cross and the love of the cross, then that will be evidenced in a life that is concerned about eternal issues, about righteousness, about your mouth, about how you live, about honouring God. Is that true of you this evening? Is that claim to being saved by the cross borne out in a life that isn't about wealth, isn't about money, isn't about silly, ephemeral things, but a life that's about God, righteousness, and His kingdom? Amen.